Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And now this question: how do we uphold transparency and accountability in the federal court system? In short, the public's right to know, with a judge's desire to protect the identity of jurors when they might be in danger. It's an important question because sometimes, like in a terrorism trial, jurors might be in danger if their identities, their addresses were made public. This question was at the heart of a decision last month by the First Circuit Court of Appeals. The court ruled that in federal trials, jurors' names and addresses must be released in a timely manner after the verdict. Now, full disclosure here, WBUR was front and center in this case. Our lawyers, BU lawyers that is, filed multiple motions requesting the release of jury lists during a number of high-profile cases, including a terrorism case and another case about responsibility for a deadly meningitis outbreak. WBUR's special correspondent David Boeri led our efforts, and he joins us now in the studio. David, it's great to see you back.
Great to see you,
Anthony. Thank you for coming in. Also with us in our studio is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Nancy, always good to have you.
Good to be here.
So, listeners, if you have questions about this, we'd love to get you in on the conversation. Do you think releasing the names and addresses of jurors is vital for transparency in our judicial process? You're going to hear a lot of reasons why it is. If you served on a jury, would you want your information out there, or are you concerned about privacy, about safety? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, David, let me start with you with this most basic question. For a lot of folks out there, it might not be obvious to them, but why is it important that a journalist like you, journalists like us, should have access to members of a jury after a trial?
To find out what influenced the jurors in reaching their verdicts. This is an important thing. The courts have always recognized it's important that we, in a democracy, criminal trial should not, as a rule, be tried by anonymous witnesses. That we don't have secret trials. The trial, what happens, the arguments made in court are publicized. And so there's a need to talk to the jurors afterwards to find out how they're influenced. And let me tell you, over the course of several years covering the federal court here, I talked to one of the Tsarnaev jurors before the list was released. And what was it? Well, he told us that as far as he was concerned, the critical information was that Zhahar Tsarnaev standing beside a bag for 4.5 minutes. That was the critical decision, as far as he was concerned, the critical piece of information. In the Top Chef case, which you recall involved union activity against the show Top Chef, we talked to the jurors there. After we got the list, their names, we tracked them down. They told us that they were overwhelmingly in favor of acquittal, which raises the question of whether that charge by the U.S. Attorney's Office was overzealous, whether it should have ever been filed in the first place. There's lots of information you can get from jurors.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a couple of cases there. What cases in particular led you to pursue these lists and eventually to take this case to court?
So, over the course of time, I recognized that, in fact, a number of federal judges were not following what's been the ruling precedent in this district since 1990, which is that the proceedings are presumed to be public and that jurors' names shall be released after the verdict. And so I recognized that we weren't getting the list, or we were getting the names but not the addresses. The addresses turn out to be critical to identifying people. So there were two in particular that broke in the same year. One involved the New England Compounding Center case, and the other one involved a terrorist, a so-called homegrown terrorist, David Wright, in a separate trial. We sought the jury list in both those cases. In the New England Compounding Center case, which, as you know, has a major interest nationally because over 76 deaths had resulted from contaminated samples, that are, right. Contaminated medicines that had gone out from Framingham. So we applied for that, we filed a motion for that list. The judge would not grant us the names and the addresses, which were critical to finding the jurors. He wouldn't do it.
Right. I want to come back to how important that is. But Nancy Gertner, Judge Gertner, I'd love to ask you about this, your perspective as a judge. Could you talk a little bit about this precedent? How soon after a verdict is a jury list expected to be released, and how much and how much information is expected to be released with that list?
The jury list includes the names and addresses of jurors.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be released in a timely fashion. The court doesn't necessarily define it. But the rule since 1990, affirmed over and over again by the First Circuit, by the plan for selection in the district, was that jury lists become public information after the trial and shall be released unless a court finds that the interests of justice require that it doesn't. Mm. And what that means is, typically it means that law developed in mob cases where there were credible threats of jury tampering and against the jurors. So the presumption is disclosure unless you can say that there is a threat of harm involved. After the trial is over, things change, right? There's no concern about, there's no Sixth Amendment concern, jury trial right concern, that the pool will be, that the somehow the trial will be tainted by publicity. The trial is over. There's been a conviction. So that slides away. There is a concern that, you know, wonderful reporters like David will be dogging jurors to disclose secret jury deliberations. That is a concern. There's no question about it. But we have a First Amendment. There are lots of things that people want to keep secret. But the First Amendment trumps those
and Anthony,
things.
Yeah, go ahead, David.
In our cases.
Are you going to disagree with me, David?
No, actually, I'm not. But I'm going to point out that in those cases that we were involved with, there were no findings made by the judges that there was a credible threat to the jury or to the judicial process. Instead, what happened in our cases was that the judges raised the threat of the internet, something that was new, that wasn't there in 1990, but they now talked about the invasion of privacy that it would be involved because those names would be out there, the addresses would be out there.
I see.
And so there was a projection, a generalized threat, a projection of a parade of horribles that would happen, that we would suffer if, in fact, the list were given to us. So it stirs.
And a parade of horribles for the jury
that
you would contact and
That's
perhaps
right.
do a story about, and then his or her
exactly.
name would be catapulted around the
right,
internet.
Right, but just because the definition of public has changed doesn't mean we cease to make things public. And essentially what the court was doing was saying it didn't want the jurors to be discomfited. We didn't want them to be annoyed. That's not the finding. The issue is serious threat to them. I might add, it also, it's a very interesting conceptual problem. If you look at jurors as public decision makers, and that's what they are, then they, as part of a public proceeding, they may be annoyed by the disclosure of the lists. The jury service is certainly not fun, but they are. That's part of their public
because
obligation.
Jurors are largely decision makers. They are in the public sphere. They're seen as that. They are citizen soldiers, citizens, but sometimes soldiers called upon for a sacred duty here. And it's interesting. Let me read one of the from one of the orders by the judge denying us. This is Judge William Young, who presided over a terrorist trial involving David Wright, who had been convicted of plotting to kill Americans. We ask for the list. He writes back, and he's known for his bombastic pen. Routed and in retreat, their territorial aspirations today, but a bitter memory among blackened ruins. ISIS nonetheless remains a viciously dangerous yet shifting and shadowy group of depraved international terrorists. He then says, this court will provide no aid and comfort for ISIS propaganda. He's talking about David Bory seeking the jury list. And then says, therefore, even though there is no credible threat against anyone involved in this prosecution, I've checked, he writes. I will not follow my usual practice and reveal the names and home addresses of the jurors now that the case is over. So there you have it. He had made no finding, no finding of any credible threat. And Stearns did the same thing in denying, Judge Stearns in denying us that list, when in fact we were talking about a pharmacist, Al Capone.
But wait a minute. Let me just stick with Judge. It's Judge Young, right?
Right.
Judge Young's point there isn't the point that the sort of dreadful potential and possibility of an ISIS terrorist agent could actually befall on one of these jurors. Isn't that a sort of reasonable and responsible way to think about
it? It is a possibility, and how do we measure possibilities? Let's look at the statistics.
Right.
There's never been a known retaliation against a juror after a verdict, whose name was released after a verdict.
Not only that, if one can withhold names based on speculation of, you know, what's going on in Syria, then we've closed the proceedings. There's a risk, I suppose, but unless it's a credible risk, unless there's some issue with respect to it, then this is a public proceeding and these are public actors.
We've got a couple of interesting questions on the line. Listeners, if you want to join this conversation, we're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about releasing the names and addresses of jurors and how it's vital for transparency in our judicial process. A recent court case upheld that principle. What do you think? Let's go to John, who's calling from Roslindale. Go ahead, John. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, fascinating discussion, and it's a very difficult balancing act. I've been to law school. I've worked in legal research and in Chicago, and the gangs in Chicago are similar to some of the threatening patterns that you've discussed already. And I think there might be a happy medium where the jurors can be, even maybe mandated by law, accessible to certain journalists after the trial for a period of time as part of the jury service even. And that way, valuable work like David Boeri's and others can be done without necessarily disclosing the names of these people, because I know that I've served as a juror. I've also served as a witness in a murder trial, and it can be intimidating. I mean, my situation where I served was nothing compared to, let's say, some gangland situations in South Chicago, which I think would be extremely dangerous.
John, I got it. If you put an interesting idea on the table, John, I really appreciate the call. What do you think, Judge Gert? Let me come to you first. What do you think about the kind of compromise that John was suggesting there and the real expression of concerns about privacy there?
Well, two things. One is the question of making jurors available to journalists that we certify. How does that jibe with the First Amendment in a social media age? That's number one. And number two, we've had 200 years of jury trials in this country. And if in any case there is a credible threat, a judge makes findings that there's a credible threat. It's not speculation. It's not, boy, this is a difficult case. It's a credible threat is the standard. And that's the only basis under which, you know, you close the First Amendment door. So I think it can't be these are bad cases and these are bad defendants. It has to be more than that, and we can live with that standard.
Yeah, go ahead.
So it's important to note that Al Capone was tried and convicted by jurors who were not anonymous. Their names were out there. So you have the statistical record, but I'd also suggest, and I appreciate the comments of the caller, I'd also suggest, though, that that without the names of the jurors being provided, then you have anonymous people at secret trials, essentially. And one has to wonder if somebody who knows his name will never be revealed will act differently in convicting somebody or sending someone, giving someone the death penalty as to not.
Interesting. I want to bring in another voice. Jeffrey Pyle is an attorney with Prince Lobel Tai who represented WBUR in this case. And Jeffrey Pyle, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good afternoon.
So what is the latest on this case? It's not completely settled yet, is it?
No. The First Circuit has decided to give Judge Stearns an opportunity to meet the high standard that Judge Gertner just told your listeners about, a threat to the judicial system itself. The First Circuit has remanded the case to the district court to determine whether there is a sufficient justification for withholding the home addresses of the jurors in this case. We argued at the First Circuit level and at the district court level that this is a case about a pharmacist who ran a dirty lab that resulted in a nationwide meningitis outbreak. This isn't the kind of rare circumstance where a court could find that there was some threat to the judicial system from withholding addresses.
Yeah.
But I want to also point out another benefit to these to releasing jury lists, and that relates to a different WBUR reporter named Bruce Gellerman. Bruce tracked down a juror from the murder trial of a young African American man in Massachusetts in 1986, and that juror told Bruce Gellerman that two jurors had mentioned to her that they assumed that the defendant in that case, a guy named Darrell Diamond Jones, was guilty because he was black.
You know, I'm going to just stop you right there because we actually have a little bit of tape from Bruce Gellerman's reporting on this case, on the conviction of Darrell Jones, who, as you pointed out, spent 32 years in prison for a murder he claims he never did. Let's just listen to this.
The first day of deliberation, there was two men. They were taken like a poll of the jury, you know, and I said not guilty. And these two fellows said guilty, guilty. I said, is it because he's black? And they said, yes. How do you like that?
So that was the juror, Eleanor Urbati, who Bruce Gellerman contacted. So, Jeff Pyle, a good example of the importance of releasing these names and ways to contact the jurors.
Well, exactly. And it shows the prescience of the First Circuit decision in 1990 that held that these jury lists have to be made public, because the court held and observed that there are many ways in which access to jurors can root out injustice, expose misconceptions among jurors, and otherwise serve the interests of justice. This isn't about prying into individual jurors' lives. This is about making sure that our judicial system works and produces just outcomes.
So let me just ask one sort of pushback question. I could imagine a potential juror saying, you know, I don't know if I feel comfortable giving an objective, honest response if I know you're going to release my name when this is all over, because some folks that maybe I don't want to deal with are going to come after me. What do you think? I mean, I'm going to put that question to anyone.
Right. I mean, there's a tension here. There's no question about it. We believe in, on the one hand, secret jury deliberations. We tell jurors, I told jurors, that, you know, the press may get in touch with you. We would prefer that you don't talk about the deliberations, because the sort of the reverse of what David said, which is you want people to be free to vote their conscience without feeling recrimination in their neighborhood, on the one hand. But we also don't tell jurors, you may not speak to the press. That tension between we would prefer that the deliberations are secret so as to free them up doesn't mean that you shut the door to the First Amendment. That's the tension here. And frankly, usually, the juror who comes forward, as in Bruce's case, is a juror who's suffering over something.
Yeah.
Now that was
last point to you,
years.
David, because I know we've got like 15 seconds left, but I want to give you the last word. Go ahead.
It is all about accountability, that we need openness and accountability. And in this case, the Court of Appeals ruled that it is that nothing about the new internet age changes the fact that there's a need for accountability and transparency in our system of justice.
David Boeri, WBUR special correspondent, thanks for coming in. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
All the great work you do. Nancy Gertner, WBUR legal analyst and former federal judge, thank you. It's always great to have you.
Thank you.
And Jeffrey Pyle, attorney with Prince Lobel Tye, who represented WBUR in this case. Jeffrey, thank you for your time today, and thank you for your work, important work on this case. We're very grateful.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, choreographer Mark Morris pays tribute to the Beatles. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.